Welcome back to this monthly meeting of the Governance and Intergovernmental Relations Committee of Denver City Council. Thanks for joining us for the discussion. The Governance and Intergovernmental Relations Committee starts now.
The green light is not on yet.
Oh, please.
I don't mean it. I take it back.
Good morning,
everyone. The green light is on now. I'm Amanda Sawyer. Thank you for joining us. This is the first Government and Intergovernmental Relations Committee. Those of you who follow Denver City Council know that we changed up some of our committees in July. And so this is a committee that meets once a month to talk about state legislative priorities, federal legislative priorities, also the auditor's office and a couple of other, the clerk's office and a couple of other agencies are a part of this committee. So this is our first one. I'm Amanda Sawyer. I have the honor of representing District 5 and also chairing this committee. Today we have a conversation with our state lobbyists as well as council members to talk about what happened at special session, what is coming up at the state in the next session that starts in January, although the work starts before then. And just to let everyone know, to set expectations, after we have our conversation today, what we would like to do is send out a survey to all city council members just to get your feedback on any of your priorities, and then we will come back together and meet in November for a more in-depth conversation with council members and our lobbyists about what our priorities are and how they might dovetail with the work that's being done at the state. So thank you all for joining us for this. Before we get started, we're gonna do a round of introductions, and I'm gonna start to my left.
Hi everyone, Serena Gonzalez-Gutierrez, one of the council members at large.
Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3.
Gara Watson, Fine District 9.
Paul Cashman, South Denver District 6.
Sarah Parody, your other council member at large.
Chantel Lewis, District 8.
Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver District 4.
And Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver District 2.
Fantastic. Well, since our lobbying team just arrived, do you guys need a minute? Or are you ready to go? If you are, come on up to the table and then please introduce yourselves and then we'll get started. Tell us what happened at special session and what you are anticipating is coming in January.
Yes.
And before, because JBC starts meeting soon.
Right, very soon.
And the budget is top of everyone's mind.
It is, unfortunately.
All right, well, good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Adam Paul with the mayor's office. And we've had a little bit of a change this year in our legislative committee makeup. We have the chair, Councilor Sawyer, has now joined us, as well as Councilor Gonzalez-Gutierrez on the council side. And then Tim Hoffman and myself will be representing the mayor's office. And Becky Studemeyer will be helping support us. And of course, we have Dominic Moreno, who will kind of quarterback a lot of this, as he's all things state and a great resource to have. And as the chair mentioned, we had set kind of joint priorities last year, and I think it worked really well. And just on a high level, they were affordable housing and homelessness, business and labor support, climate response, safe transportation options, support for youth and families, health access, public and community safety. And so we will begin the same process where we'll go out to the agencies and meet with the mayor and get a better understanding of things that they're seeing or opportunities where Denver can engage on legislation. Come back once you all have done your side in November, we'll work on a joint statement and look at how we can move forward to the better effect. I know there's some things that council would like to see, some legislation. There's some things that we've been briefed on from some of the agencies as well. So we'll start to look at doing that. And then of course we'll have a reception sometime in December, where we'll meet with all of our Denver delegation and have the opportunity to share our joint priorities with them. So that's a little bit on our side. We'll have the lobby team, if you want to just introduce yourselves.
Hi, everyone. I'm Heather Retzko, a member of the Policy Matters team. It's nice to see you all today.
Katie Hancock, also a member of Policy Matters.
Jimena Luna, also a member of Policy Matters.
Tanya Mattis, Kelly Bowery. Nice to see everyone. Policy Matters.
All right. We'll go ahead and get going and start with the special session.
All right, so just an overview of what happened during special session. The General Assembly considered 21 House bills, 3 House resolutions, 9 Senate bills, and 1 Senate resolution. Most did not advance, with only 11 bills surviving until the end. Measures adopted only partially address the state's 2025-26 revenue losses, and they do little to resolve the much larger challenges that we anticipate in 2026, 2027, and beyond. Internally, the city and county of Denver took a position on 3 bills. Senator Rodriguez's increased transparency for algorithmic systems, Representative Lindstedt's consumer protections for artificial intelligence interaction, and then the healthy school meals for all that we'll talk about a little bit. So for the consumer protections for artificial intelligence interaction, the House bill, it was characterized as the industry bill, drawing support from small and large businesses, school districts, local governments, and other public entities, and it died on the calendar. Increased transparency for algorithmic systems was seen as the consumer solution, drawing support from stakeholders like the labor union and the ACLU. After negotiations fell apart due to disagreements over liability protections for developers and deployers, Senator Rodriguez ran a strike below amendment that just extended the implementation of SB 24205 until June 30th, 2026.
What is a strike below amendment, excuse me?
That's totally fine, yeah. Yeah, that's just when they basically run an amendment that strikes everything in the bill and then just added in the provision that pushed out the implementation date.
So they kicked the can down the road.
That's exactly.
We're gonna have a conversation about that in a minute.
Exactly.
And then Healthy School Meals for All. This bill just updates Proposition MM to allow revenue raised under the measure for Healthy School Meals for All program to also allow SNAP to be eligible for those funds.
If I can just jump in there, we were really pleased, too, that our Department of Human Services testified in favor of the bill and did a really good job. And we got a lot of good feedback from the legislators about our participation in that. Sorry, Adam.
No, and I was just going to say, as a refresher, the AI bill has been polarizing at the end of session last session, you know, up until midnight before we almost finished, there was pushes to do different things. Again, this one was, and I think the committee felt that we were in enough contact that if we needed to jump into a support or opposed position on either, we could, but it was better just to monitor to see because it's so politically charged and there's so many different moving pieces. And so again, we'll see this later on, but it will be a top, I think, priority bill for many this next session.
So moving on to the budget, as we mentioned, it's certainly a hot topic right now and a lot of the reason why we had a special session in the first place. The Governor's Office of State Planning and Budgeting issued in its revenue forecast that they anticipated a $1.2 billion shortfall in the current fiscal year. So that is different than past times that we've talked about the budget, because that meant that they had to go back and make cuts to a budget that they had already passed, which is incredibly challenging. After absorbing some of the budget cut with surplus dollars, there was a $783 million hole. And so the strategy from the governor's office was to tackle that with the use of 3 different revenue sources. One, the surplus, using some of the surplus, 2% of the surplus is what they ended up agreeing to. And then some of the bills that Katie talked about, and Tanya will walk us through them in a second, they passed a handful of revenue generating bills that really targeted different tax breaks, if you will, especially around business. Generated about $252 million. So we used a third reserve, a third with the revenue generating bills, and then the governor's office had to come in and present a plan with a third, the remaining third with a plan for cuts. The interesting thing, and there was quite a bit of debate about that as well during the special session, is the use of the reserve triggers the governor's office to have to submit a plan on how to balance the budget. This, again, is really different and unique in terms of how we normally balance a budget, where we would go through the Joint Budget Committee. We, our team, and Adam, and you all have a chance to opine on the different decisions that they're making. That's not the case when we use the reserve. The governor's office has sort of uncharted authority to submit a plan, and it is what it is. The big part of that plan that we wanted to flag for you all is they reduced the 1.6% provider rate increase that we were able to fight so hard for and get implemented last year. County HCPCF County Administration received the same increase. That's just how it kind of works. The provider rates increase the county administration. And so we're estimating about $1.3 million statewide as a cut impact on counties. The directors of human services are right now working to put that new sort of allocation through the formula. And so we're not exactly quite sure yet what the number for Denver will be. But as soon as we have that, we'll certainly let you all know.
Can I just jump in there and just let council members know, in your fun reading 1,000-page budget book that you got yesterday, there are comments about some of the changes at the state and their impact to the city in the first portion of where it talks about the general fund right after kind of the Schedule 100 form. So I don't know the exact page number today. Sorry, guys. It's somewhere around page 88 that it starts talking about things like the marijuana revenue reduction from 10% to, I think it's 3%, which will have a fiscal impact on the city of Denver. There are a few things like that that are flagged in the beginning of the budget book by our Department of Finance, and so worth taking a look at those to see kind of what those impacts are to us. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. And so just looking forward, on the 22nd of this month, we're going to receive a new the September revenue forecast from the governor's office and legislative council. That is going to be a key indicator as to what we're looking at facing the next budget cycle. What we're hearing so far from prior revenue forecasts and also just from the continued impacts of HR1 implementation, they're expecting a deficit again, and up to potentially $1.2 billion again. And I think the challenging thing that remains is that it really is a structural deficit with some of the cuts that the governor's office put out, especially in HCPCF. The idea there was to kind of slow caseload growth and slow some of the pressures, especially around, they eliminated some of the prior authorization legislation that they had passed in years past. So I think they're really looking at it in a structural way. And so we anticipate, you know, just another challenging year ahead, unfortunately.
Yeah, and just to echo what Heather said, one of the big issues that did really come up when the governor and Mark Ferrandino, the head of OSBB, presented was that many of the legislators said they were very concerned that a lot of unfunded mandates were now going to be going back to the cities and counties mm-hmm. for them to pay for. We did have legislators ask some of those questions, and he also received quite a bit of pushback regarding the provider rate. There's one option, which I don't think they'll pursue because, as Heather just mentioned, the budget situation continues to be terrible. The reason they had to meet in the special session is because they had to do these base building cuts so that they didn't have to cut twice as much the next session that they're coming in. But there is an option that they can, through supplementals, the Joint Budget Committee can go back and revisit some of those decisions that the governor made, but that can't happen until January. So a lot of those cuts will already have been impacted, already been put into place, and then they have to come up with where they're going to get the revenue to replace those cuts that they're taking back from the governor's office. So it's probably highly unlikely, but at least it was interesting to see which areas they targeted. Councilwoman Parody, I did follow up with HCPCF, and there's a work group on the work requirement issue that you asked us. So I've got some contact information, which I'll get to you. They're still very much in disarray. Many of the cuts that were made on some of these revenue bills, they're having to create and hire more staff to comply with the HR1 the federal bill that passed into place new requirements. And so we're kind of wondering, really, how are these cuts going to take take place, if they're still going to have to augment FTE, if they're going to have to create new programs. So a lot of that, as Heather and Katie and Jimena and I have been looking at, are sort of going to come out and play into the future. We wanted to highlight these revenue generating bills just because without this passage, they would have had to cut more. And so these are the few that passed during the special session. The qualified business income deduction add back, there was a federal decoupling. Our state laws are completely, for taxes, are in sync with the federal laws. And so they took back some of the federal corporate write-offs so that they could generate some additional funding and ran a statute to change that for the state of Colorado. The corporate income tax foreign jurisdictions, that was an easy low-hanging fruit one that they wanted to really look at. Insurance premium tax rate for home offices, there was a provision that was run that if you had a home office, if you're an insurance company in Colorado, you could get a write-off. Many of the insurance companies had bigger offices in other states, but only had 2% of their home office here to qualify for that. So they did eliminate that to generate about $44 million. The sale of tax credits, this was a pretty significant one and garnered quite a bit of debate. Because of the way Tabor works, when we are in an ability or in a situation where we can take advantage of some of those tax credits, but once we reach that Tabor cap again, those will have to go away. So it's not a permanent tax fix. It's not a permanent fix to the budget. Just depends on where we are with under or over that Tabor cap. But they did pass the sale of tax credits. And then eliminating state sales tax vendor fee, there was a final issue that was resolved between the restaurants on the vendor fee and some of the small businesses. So it generated significantly lower than they initially hoped for the vendor fee, but at least it generated some, and people ended up coming around to come up with that negotiation. So as Heather mentioned, this was a pretty significant one-third, about $245 million was generated of ongoing revenue that they needed to make cuts to help pay for the budget gap that we were experiencing.
And I would just add, too, I think the governor's office is certainly continuing to be strategic and think through new ideas to just be coupled with these revenue-generating bills. They're certainly anticipating significant budget pressures, like I mentioned, on the state budget next year. One of those is certainly SNAP, the change in the state share. From HR 1 is significant. As Katie mentioned, in Senate Bill 3, they allowed just the remaining funds in the Healthy School Meals program to be allocated towards SNAP. They don't think that's going to be enough. It likely won't be enough. And so that's going to put significant pressure on the state budget and likely the county budget as well and county administration. So that's certainly something that's on our radar and we'll continue to monitor.
And that's a great follow-up. That bill still has to go to the ballot for a vote of the people. So that's the other piece, that if that does not pass a vote of the people, they're back to a lot more additional revenue that's needed should that not pass for Healthy Meals and SNAP. Questions on those key bills? We'll move on to other legislation.
Why don't we hold our questions till the end, but I've got a couple of council members in the queue already.
Great. That sounds great. And then artificial intelligence, I think as Adam mentioned, and as our Councilwoman Sawyer mentioned, this is definitely a kick the can down the road. They could not come to agreement on fundamental policy issue changes, especially around the issue of liability, as Heather stated. And so I do think there's going to be probably quite a bit of stakeholdering and more meetings, but certainly something that we'll see again during the next legislative session. Robert Rodriguez, our majority leader and also one of our Denver members, has really been a lead on trying to figure this out. He was the original sponsor of Senate Bill 205. And then William Lindstedt and a number of House members have really gotten up to speed on this issue as well and have been working more collaboratively with the business community. Robert's been working more with labor, but really trying to find solutions across the board. And so I think we'll just be respectful and participate because it's so important to us, and we will keep you all posted on those.
Before you move on from that, can I just ask Adam to maybe weigh in from the mayor's office perspective and from the agency perspective on what our concern is with that in terms of implementation?
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think mainly on the city side, the implementation piece is making sure, and I think there was a carve out for municipalities, for local government. But I think that'll have to go back in because that was in the strike below. So that'll be something to make sure that we're able to utilize that for different things. And I think there was an email that went out that had from Tech Services, would have come from Victoria maybe, that had some great information on how the city already uses that. And we can provide that as well. So that's one piece as far as the city goes. And then also striking the balance between privacy protection and innovation. Making sure that businesses that are here or want to relocate to the city of Denver, you know, this isn't burdensome for them or for smaller businesses as far as implementation and liability. So there's a big liability component also as to if it's passed in a certain way, what does that do to the people that are providing, building, or utilizing? So a lot of different facets, and it's just super political as we've seen. Mm-hmm. And I think trying to find that right balance of protections and innovation is going to be the key to bring people together and move it forward.
Thanks. For the Foster Youth Benefits Bill, last session, Colorado enacted House Bill 1271, which required counties to screen foster youth for Social Security survivor benefits, apply for those benefits when eligible, manage and conserve funds and trust accounts, and prohibit the use of those funds to offset foster care costs. So we've heard that in 2026, legislators may pursue a follow-up bill applying those same requirements to Social Security dependent benefits. And so that was a benefit type that was not addressed in House Bill 1271 and would add additional projected fiscal and administrative impacts, especially for counties. And so we are continuing to monitor and we'll update y'all when we hear anything more. And then for the gun exchange background check requirements. So right now when you go to turn in a gun, you are subjected to a background check. And so we are trying to meet with Majority Leader Duran to see what we can do to get that requirement taken out just because we see it as a barrier. So we will update y'all on that as well.
Thank you. And I will just jump in and say I have been begging for this. So has our chief of police for several years. In 2022, we worked with the Broncos, the city of Aurora, and the city of Denver, and a nonprofit organization called Bra Tools that turns old, they're blacksmiths, and they turn old weapons that have been cut up into jewelry and gardening tools. And we took almost 1,000 weapons off the street that year that were turned in voluntarily by people. But we had to work with a nonprofit organization to run it because of this background check law. Because you cannot go to the police department if you've inherited your grandfather's World War II service revolver that you do not want. You can't go to the police station and turn it in. They will have to do a background check on themselves. And so that's really dumb. And should be changed because we want to incentivize people to do that. Because what we see in our crime statistics in the city of Denver is that, you know, obviously in a gun buyback program, we're not expecting people who are using their weapons for illegal purposes to turn in their guns. But we see a lot of people who are the victims of crime. Their house gets broken into, their car gets broken into, and they're leaving a gun in their car unsecured in violation of the state law. And those get stolen and used in other crimes. So we want to provide a way for people to turn those in. So that's why this is so important to me. And it's, you know, it's a good law to have this background check in place. But there's got to be some sort of carve out for turning it into your local police station so that people can do that. Thanks.
And then just as Heather mentioned, we are waiting for the September revenue forecast that will be out on the 22nd. This should provide us with an idea of kind of the fiscal note implications for next session to see, you know, what level of fiscal note a bill can come with and it be unlikely or likely to pass. And then also will give us outlook on HR 1 costs, specifically around Medicaid and SNAP for years to come.
All right, thank you. We've got a number of council members in the queue. We'll start with Councilmember Flynn.
Hi, Madam Chair. Maybe I missed this. Or flew by me, but there seems to be about almost $300 million still remaining that I'm not understanding how they filled. $783 million budget hole after absorbing part of the $1.2 billion. And it was offset with cuts and adjustments of $252 million. And then revenue bills, $245 million. And when I subtract that from 783, I come up with $285 million still as a gap.
So very good.
How did they, is this a balanced budget or not?
They cut the reserve. So that's the last piece. They cut that reserve. You were very good on your numbers, too.
That number. We are very impressed.
Yes.
You monitored.
Our former Joint Budget Committee member, Dominic Moreno, is very impressed, Councilman. Yeah, that's exactly what they did. And so that's what ended up prompting that they cut the reserve. So when they cut that reserve, as Heather mentioned, then they still had to come back after this special session and come up with the long-term ongoing cuts to make up.
Okay, that's what you were talking about in the beginning of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you
so
for that question.
So that's a 13%?
Yeah.
And then the other question I had was about MM. And SNAP, and then on slide four, you talk about how they adjusted the ballot measure to allow the revenue raise through there to be used also for SNAP. But then on the next slide, it may cover only half. So can you put dollar amounts on that? Because half of MM doesn't mean anything to me.
So the way that they're structuring the ballot measure is everything will have to go to the Healthy School Meals for All program first, including setting up a reserve for that program. And then whatever is kind of in excess of that is expected to go to SNAP. So I think it's estimated to be around $70 million that will go to SNAP after the Healthy School Meals for All program is all sorted. $70 million in SNAP is just not going to
I think you noted on slide five is that make a $150 to $200 million gap in SNAP. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Great. Councilmember Cashman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not as whiz at math as my good friend is. So explain to me how Tabor plays into the budget deficit and all that stuff.
We have a lot of experts on Tabor here. She did her thesis on Tabor and how it interacts with the budget. So I think the key piece right now is when there's a Tabor surplus, there's a cap of how much you can, if you go above the cap or below the cap. If you're below the cap, you have room between what the costs of things are and how much that Tabor cap is. And because we've had such good years with, you know, the revenue that came in from the feds, the surplus, the coronavirus relief, there was quite a lot of space. What happened now is that we've creeped up to very, very close to that cap now of Tabor. And so what that means is the earned income tax credit, the family tax credits that cost significant dollars that there was space for going up to that Tabor cap now are potentially going to push like the homestead exemption, which helps the senior citizens, up above the cap, which means then they'll have to cut general fund to pay for that obligation. And so what they're looking at and what they're playing around with, that's why some of these tax credit bills, is it really a fix? We don't know, because it depends on the next revenue forecast that we're going to see on the 20th, the 22nd of September, to see where are we with the Tabor cap, whether we're above
sure.
or below.
Simplify even more. If we get rid of Tabor tomorrow, what does that do for our budget deficit? Anything?
Well,
please just be honest.
Yeah, well, personally, you know, I think it's very challenging because they don't have the elected officials have to go to a vote of the people to increase any revenue because of Tabor. So without Tabor, they would be allowed the tools as elected many elected officials are in other states. We're the only state in the nation with Tabor that would be allowed to do that. I think, you know, I do think, you know, some of the fundamental debate on the other side of the issue is, are we creating programs, however, that are ongoing programs that we created with one-time funds? And unfortunately, we did do that. The legislature made those decisions. The governor made some of those decisions. And there's legitimate concern about that because some of those are ongoing commitments that we now no longer have general fund for. So they're going to really have to go back and look at programs to get rid of. And they have not, since I think what, the last probably 8 or 9 years that we've been there, it's been a very positive budget situation for the state of Colorado. We have not had to make those challenging cuts. We can remember, however, a time we were here in 2008, you guys were here, 2002, when it was terrible budget times and we had to make monumental cuts. So that's what we're entering back into. Very good questions.
Yeah, I'll go deeper at another time offline. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Before we, Councilmember Parity, you're up next, but can I just ask a follow-up question to that one before you go? Are you cool with that? Parity.
Oh yeah, I'm so sorry. Okay. I thought you were asking these guys.
No.
I actually messaged you. I can get out of queue.
Oh, okay, great. So question for you guys about the potential programs that are gonna be cut and what our advocacy might look like as a city with regards to those programs. So there have been a lot of programs that have been created that are unfunded mandates and all the things that are either going to get passed down to us or they're going to have to go. And as the state is having those conversations, how will we be able to engage in that to lend our voice to what we might want to see?
Absolutely.
From cost-saving perspectives from the city?
I think, as Heather already mentioned, the governor's office has actually come to us to say, are there unfunded mandates that are onerous, that are cumbersome? Do you all have ideas about, because I think they really are trying to look at how they have the next iteration, of course, is we have the revenue forecast in September, and then on November 1st, the governor submits his budget request again for this next year. They are asking us for concepts and ideas and looking at things that potentially can help them with budget savings, but also more scalpel approach that they're not really crucifying us for the areas that we need, such as SNAP, such as some of the HCPF. Like, because Ferrandino was very appreciative of some of our efforts on some of the revenue generating bills, he was very sensitive to not, he cut the increase to the provider rates, but he did not make cuts to the provider rates. But because that generates so much general fund, I've got to believe they're going to come in with cuts during the November 1 budget request. They're trying to make them modest because that's one of the areas that we've said our mental health centers were closed, our developmental disability centers were closed. You know, a lot of the work we've done around our homeless populations, a lot of the outreach, all of those funds are tied up with some of that county admin that's so critical for our general operations. So I think both Adam and Dominic have also had really good conversations. I know with the governor's office, they've reached out to our team as well. They're going to definitely care about what the council, you know, as you move forward, they are very aware of the terrible budget cuts we've had to deal with, as you all have with both the mayor's office and the council members for City and County of Denver. So I think we have a great seat at the table. We have a chance to interact. They're going to be doing, you know, quite a bit of outreach. I think there's going to be more interim meetings as we get ready and people start putting their bills in, which will start happening in September. Well, really this month and October are the big months to start getting those bills filed. Mm-hmm. So we're happy to just keep those communication channels open.
Adam, yeah. And this is just a little bit different. This is going back to Councillor Cashman's question. So with Tabor, right, and the limitations that you have on raising revenue, there's also a potential two initiatives that are going through the process right now that would limit fees, which fees are ways that you can still find opportunities to generate. And these would then, if one of them states, if a fee raises over $100 million in 5 years, has to go to a vote of the people. So, you know, these things are also working through where they've taken the Tabor piece on the vote. Now that fee piece is going to be potentially under attack. And I think that's important to have that conversation because fees are very important and they go directly to the things that they are funding.
So
we should just stop funding silly things like education and mental health, and it would help with the budget problem.
And to Adam's point, I think his is a very profound one. So, for example, one fee that is very well known as something known as the hospital provider fee that created an enterprise which funds about $3 billion worth of funding to Medicaid patients, to healthcare, mm-hmm. to how we operate, to rural hospitals, to Denver Health. So he is certainly correct. These are things that we've really got to keep an eye on because those enterprises have been key budget issues that have worked for the state of Colorado and that have worked with the law of Tabor. And so the more that those types of things are ratcheted down within these statewide ballot initiatives, it makes it harder and harder for us to come up with revenue.
Thank you.
Great. Councilmember Parity, you said you're out. You tagging out? Okay. Councilmember Torres.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What will be on the November ballot? I've heard a couple different references to things that will be there, LLMM. Anything else, whether it's from regular session or from special?
Go ahead.
I think there was one last year that we, so for sure the Healthy Meals one was one. Yes. I thought there was another one maybe around water issues.
How about this? Can you guys pull together a list of what items are going to be on the ballot in November from the state and with a description of them for us and email that out to us?
Happy to do that.
All of them. Any referred measures too.
And just looking at the Secretary of State's website, there's, you know, approved for circulation. There's seven or eight of them right now. Looking for title, there's 15.
Yeah, but those ones are not going to be on the ballot in November. My specific ask is, what is going to be on the ballot in November?
Absolutely. We can do that.
Sorry, Councilwoman Torres.
No, thank you. Also, the programs created with one-time funds, which ones are those? Are they easy to rattle off or... No.
They're not easy. Great question. So some of those, like, for example, some of them were around mental health, the interim committee on mental health. Some of them were around MAT funding, substance abuse issues. Some of them were around different programs within Department of Corrections. So there was a number of them. Some of them had some funding that went into like the preschool program, but it was more one-time funding than it was ongoing funding for universal preschool. It ended up taking up more general fund than the actual, it was initially passed because of the ballot initiative that passed, but then it required more funding. So they used some of those surplus funds. So there's a myriad of different ones. And that's the piece. Many of those legislators were bill sponsors, so it's hard to get rid of something that's your baby. But because there's not, you know, initially when those were created, it was like, let's see if these work, and then we'll go back and we'll pluck the ones off that don't work. Well, nothing was really plucked off. So now they're going to have to make those challenging decisions.
Okay. And there were a lot of different grant programs created as well within all of the departments. So education grants, higher education grants, rural health grants.
Business, OEDIT.
OEDIT, certainly. And so there... We saw some of that in the governor's budget cut that they eliminated some of those grant programs. We have a document that we can send out to you that just outlines some of the cuts.
Okay.
So you can see examples. Yeah.
Sounds good. Thank
you. And 425, it's only LL and MM right now.
Okay.
That's all that's been certified for the state right
okay.
now.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you so much. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Only those two referred and...
That's it. That's all that.
Citizen issue?
And they said there may be changes made, but as of right now, it's just those two.
Okay. Yep. Awesome. Thank you.
Good question.
Councilwoman Torres, anything else?
Good. No,
you good?
You.
Okay. Councilmember Pro Tem Romero Campbell.
Thank you. I have a question around Proposition 123. Was that touched at all, or were they taking funds, and what is that impact for Denver, affordable housing, and us?
Great question. Big concerns around that. They took, was it 101 million?
105.
105 out of the 121 they could take. So in a time of fiscal crisis, when 123 passed the ballot, there was a provision in there that said you could swipe up to 125 million if it was a fiscal crisis and emergency. So in the governor's plan, he took 101 million. A lot of people, now they did not touch the DOLA side as much as they touched the OEDIT side of things, but everyone in the affordable housing community is very, very concerned about what this does for rental assistance, what this does for a lot of the work that's been done around affordable housing. Very astute question. The governor's office was pressed on that as well. The governor himself, when he came before the Joint Budget Committee, and that what does this do to a lot of the work that they've already done? And they said we could have taken another, you know, 15 million, but we didn't do that. But I think that that is definitely going to be one that the legislature most likely may look at either through statutory changes or different provisions, because they're concerned about how that impacts the work that's been done around affordable housing. Good question.
And the DOLA side provides for support for local governments, down payment assistance, mobile home programs, new construction acquisition, single family, owner-occupied rehab. So that's 40% of that, but mostly that'll be untouched. And it sounds like, based upon what's been released, the money is going to come from OEDIT, but will mostly be impacts to land banking and equity programs. So we'll still have, for local governments, we'll have that side and that ability, but that's where they feel most of the money is going to be pulled from, on the OEDIT side.
For people watching at home, what is OEDIT?
Office of Economic Development and International Trade. Good question, Councilor.
Thank you.
About the acronyms.
No, would that also mean, so in the cycle, I heard that this next cycle is focused on rural communities, mountain communities, not the metro area. Do you know if there will be additional cycles that will also include the metro area?
I believe so, but we'll get that information.
And I have another question just related to Tabor. I know the conversation was moving forward, but is there any talk about then having effort to repeal Tabor? Is anybody going to take that one on?
So there was a pretty big, as you know, pretty big initiative last session, and that never got a hearing on the House floor. What we're hearing from leaders at the Bell, like former Representative Chris Kennedy, is that they may be looking at higher income tax, not complete elimination of Tabor, but looking at raising revenues through different tax measures.
Graduated income tax.
Graduated, mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm not higher income tax, graduated income tax, thank you.
Well, it is higher income tax for some.
It is higher, actually, absolutely. So. But we have not heard yet of any sort of outright direct appeal to just eliminate Tabor. You know, we have been hearing that over time, many different groups are looking at, is this something that we do, you know, keep going back after year to educate people about what's happening in terms of funding at the state level. But I have not heard. Have you guys heard of any? So we'll keep you posted on that, though, if we do.
Great.
Go ahead. You're okay.
One last one.
You're all good.
One last one. Well, it's just more of a comment. A thesis on Tabor. It's a little mind bending and breaking. So kudos to you. That's great.
Mena is brilliant. We're so happy to have her.
Yes, we are.
Yeah,
that's insane. Wonderful. Glad you're sitting at the table. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Councilmember Watson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question on social equity for cannabis. If I'm correct, I believe not sure what the funding mechanism was. I believe there was a deadline or end date of 2026. Were there any changes as far as when they're seeking funds within this budget process? Was social equity impacted with any of the marijuana tax impacts or anything that you all know on that?
We balanced, it looks like, with $500,000 from the marijuana tax cash fund. Not sure exactly where that falls into, but we can.
We'd love to know if that ties down to social equity. And for folks who are not as familiar, the social equity piece was provided for cannabis businesses for folks who are impacted by the war on drugs. So if you were arrested, family members were arrested, during that process and program, you received opportunity to have funding to open the cannabis stores. I'm very curious if that exists. I know there have been bills to try to make some amendments to what was available for social equity, but I haven't heard anything on the funding.
Yeah, we're happy to follow up and just make sure of that. Some of the programs that they eliminated had to do with, like, cyber. There was, like, a chunk of funds in different programs that they looked at, but let us get dig more into that to make sure, Councilman, to get you the correct information.
Okay. And the interesting thing with the governor's balancing plan is that it was just kind of bullets. It was like a dollar amount in bullets, and so these are really good questions that help us really dig in and uncover sort of the facts. So we're happy to reach out to the governor's office and get more information for you. Okay.
You good?
Thank you.
Awesome. I have a phone a friend from Councilwoman Alvarez who couldn't be here today wanting to know about impacts to CCAP funding.
So we were really successful, knock on wood, because I'm like hoping they don't whip it out. We were able to get funding into the budget. That was not an area that they did cut.
Okay.
Which is good during the special session. I think we've got to see what the forecast plays out and what happens during the November 1 budget request to see if more of those impacts are cut. But there definitely is discussion around CCAP and the Universal Preschool Program and how those work together and whether there's going to be enough funding for both of those programs. So it's certainly something we need to keep front and center. I know this is a very important priority for us. It certainly is for our Denver Department of Human Services. It's something that we actively lobby on each year. So we're happy to keep her posted on that.
That's great. Thank you. So question for you all, just to wrap up around how we can partner to move forward. There are some really big things that are coming, particularly with budget impacts, which will impact the cities and counties functions. And all of that will sort of happen this fall. So how would you like to make sure that we're all sort of on the same page and kept in the loop, and so that you can ask, you know, us whatever the advocacy is that we need to do that we can be supportive of? How you want that to work.
So I think we've done a really good job of having very frequent updates and working with you all to make sure you're in the loop. I think you're highlighting and telling us to look at some of the Denver fiscal cuts to make sure we're reviewing that. What I would recommend, starting in October, the Joint Budget Committee is going to start getting hearings and briefings from different departments on areas that they're thinking of cutting and presentation of what they're looking at. That certainly should be an opportunity for us to share with our council legislative liaison leads and Dominic and Adam and our team from the mayor's office to make sure that you guys have what we're hearing. And the great thing about those hearings and briefings is it allows us some opportunity to input and get intel before the session starts so that we're better prepared to say what those priorities are going to be. And then I think in the meantime, you know, as you're working with our agencies and as you all have your priorities and our council members are communicating with you all, letting us know, hey, these are things that we're very concerned about, could have massive impacts on us that we want you to highlight or target or pay attention to.
Awesome. Okay.
Anything to add, guys?
I think that was great.
No, I think we're off to a great start. We had a dress rehearsal with special session. And we learned a lot last session on how we can better work together and be nimble and fast in responding. And I think the more in-depth info we get from agencies based on HR1 and these things that we can get going sooner on and provide to you will help our advocacy in the long run. And so I think that we're off to a good start, but also as with last year, any improvements that you all see that we could be doing or things that you're not getting that would be important to you, please reach out.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much. We are going to, for the second part, just have a quick conversation with council members to go through our budget priorities that we set as a council and kind of how that relates to state legislation and how, if there are any things of specific interest. So if you guys want to stay for that, we'd love to have you. If you have things you need to get to, we totally get it, and you'll hear about it either way. So really appreciate you all being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Stay right over here.
Perfect. That's great. Thanks so much for coming and giving us that super important update.
Thank you.
Our amazing legislative aides are going to come on up to the table. Matt and Zara are in charge of helping us out with ensuring that we've got all the things that you all need so that we can make sure that council is on the same page to be advocating at the state. And so I, and thank you for putting together all of the stuff as well. So our backup team are these three guys right here. I appreciate you all very much. So why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Sure. So Ann Wallace, Legislative Policy Analyst. We just have a short slide deck here to kind of kick off the discussion of 2026 legislative priorities. So this conversation happened last year, I think, during an operations meeting. So what we have here is just reviewing our existing 8 budget goals that we have as a kind of starting off point, and then discussing maybe additional legislative priorities that don't fall under those budget goals, and then specific legislative policies or legislation that you are all interested and would like to kind of pursue during the session. Then we'll also talk quickly kind of about next steps following this meeting. So we have budget goals here, part one. And I don't know if I need to read through all of them, but we have budget goals. They changed a little bit from last year, so they're slightly different from last year. As you know, we had the retreat in March to sort these out. So the budget goals, and I also have here kind of the aligned state committees of reference for these goals. So for example, increased community safety, you might have bills going through the House and Senate Judiciary Committee, House and Senate Health and Human Services Committee that are kind of related to that budget goal. So that just kind of shows you the budget goals and then the aligned committees of reference here. And budget goals for 2. So here, budget goals 5, 6, and 7. And the committees of reference. And then this slide just prompts you to discuss additional legislative priorities that kind of fall beyond the budget goals. And I'm just here to take notes.
All right, Councilman Gonzalez Gutierrez, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, so I just sent out to all the council members, just as a refresher, a reminder, the 2025 legislative goals. Adam had a hard copy of it, but it basically was the joint goals that we had with the mayor's office last year for the 2025 session. And also, as just a reminder from last year, what we had done was what we took our budget goals and utilized those in uplifting what priorities we would have at the state level, because I think we did find alignment, because there is alignment, as we saw and in the presentation, of how those align with the state. They just might look a little bit different, or the asks might be a little bit different than they are for us at the local level, right? Because when we're setting up our budget goals, we're talking about our specific budget. But I think in the conversations that we have when we talk about budget goals, we're actually also talking about values. We're also actually talking about policy, and some of those things will play out at the state level as well and impact us in a different kind of way. That's all I have.
Okay, fantastic. And I will say that I do think, you all know I'm a big believer in local control. I think that this state leadership in particular has undercut local control repeatedly over the course of the last few state sessions. And we are a home rule sitting in county, and we need to start acting like it. Because if we do not, we are going to lose the ability to legislate on a lot of these issues. And so, you know, we saw it happen with ADUs, we saw it happen with parking, we saw it happen with transit-oriented communities. And I think the challenge is that as the capital city and the largest city, with some very clear goals and some very clear directions and things like our land use plans, that many other cities in the state of Colorado don't have, right? Delta does not have the same kinds of land use plans and the intricacies as Denver does. And sorry, Delta, if you're watching, didn't mean to use you as a specific example. And so with the state, when they are legislating for, those rural communities that do not have the kinds of challenges that we have and do not have the kinds of organization that we have. And that's why home rule cities exist, cities and counties exist, right? But I do think that this has become a pattern. It is a pattern that is very dangerous to us and our legislative authority. We have already, as city council members, agreed to give up significant authority that we have by being complicit in following the state mandates as opposed to fighting them. And I think we need to think about that and the importance of that and have a conversation about that. Because I do think that local control is an extremely important issue, and it's something that we don't talk about a lot. But we have given up a significant amount of authority, and we will give up more, because that is the direction state legislators are heading. Thoughts on this from anyone?
Yes.
Councilmember Flynn.
Thank you.
Okay.
What's really aggravating about those issues, particularly land use, is that the legislature has acted in areas where we already were acting. We already were doing citywide ADUs, but we did it more intentionally with a lengthy public process. And then after that, the legislature came in and stripped that local process away and said, it doesn't matter, these are your standards. And the same is true with other areas with parking minimums. We already were acting on that. With single stair, we're already acting on that. And so I fully support what the Madam Chair has said. The city has won every home rule litigation that we've ever engaged in. I know there are three. I can't remember the third, but I know assault weapons ban under Councilwoman Kathy Reynolds was challenged at the state level. We won that. We won the residency rule litigation. We partnered with Durango and I think Aspen. This was back in the 80s or 90s after the Poundstone Amendment stopped our annexations. And so it's a strong principle if we defend it, right? But especially when we're moving in the same direction. To have 100 people, many of whom live in Delta, and I'm sorry for picking on Delta today.
Yeah, poor Delta. We do not mean to be picking on you, Delta.
I can't even get people in my district to watch these, so I doubt anybody from Delta's watching. But for 100 legislators, most of whom come from outside of Denver, to set standards for our land use is absurd. We're doing the things that we should be doing. Let us do it. So that's my only comment. I did have an unrelated
question. Yes, you are in the queue for after my soapbox moment. And there's one more slide. But Councilmember Watson, I think, wanted to respond
as well. I think the valid point, I mean, I'm coming to the end of my chair of the Metro Area County Commissioners, and this is something that's going to be one of our priorities looking into 2025, 2026. It's ensuring that we're working as a metro region, looking at local control issues and making sure that we are being very proactive in the work that we do. So I think as for Denver, I think that's something we need to really focus on. A lot of those land use issues are causing us difficulties, especially the ADUs and when it comes to suburban setbacks. All of those things are the legislature isn't considering those discussions that we have within the community. And so with you 100% of this being a priority, that's all.
Great, thanks. Councilmember Parity, thoughts?
Yeah. I just would say I don't think that we have, I mean, I guess I want to make a pointed note that we have not chosen to, since we were moving in the same direction on ADUs and things like that, we have not challenged those land use bills, right? And that could be different in the future if we didn't share the priority. So I don't think that we've given up power. I just think that we've continued trucking along on things that we were working on anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, didn't have a need to move on those things. That's how I view that.
Yeah, I will say we'll talk about ADUs on the next slide because that's not true.
That's the one item.
Councilmember Torres.
Hi. Just like a high up perspective that I have and incredibly interested, I think, in how we use home rule, when we use it, and when we exercise that. I also recognize, you know, we share a border with a lot of jurisdictions. Lakewood is one of my influencing examples because they have chosen to be so limiting on growth and development, which puts intense pressure on my district. I see it every day when it comes to who has options for new builds or new housing, directly affecting my district when we have another jurisdiction that refuses to build. And so I also see the kind of global, right, impact that some of these things can have when they're applied to everyone. I also understand, I think, the piece about when we need to defend home rule and when, but I think there is just some nuance that I can't ignore there either when it is knocking on our door. So thank you.
Yeah, I think that's really valuable perspective and don't disagree with you. But I do think we're coming up against a hard point here. Yeah.
And thank you. I think I echo a lot of the sentiments that Councilmember Torres brought forth. If we have this as a priority, so this is just for clarification, if we have this as a priority, basically it means that we are watching, that it will be elevated. What I would like to do is to keep our eye on it so that we can have those nuanced conversations as things are coming through. And I really appreciate the new part of the process of having our agencies weigh in to what that impact is within Denver. I know that was added in this last session, and I really like that aspect of hearing from agencies as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Anne, do you want to go on to the next slide? And then, oh, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I asked to be in the queue.
So you're in the queue, but you're behind Flynn. But Flynn said he wanted to get back in, so I messed that up. Go ahead.
Oh, my bad. Okay. Yeah, for this particular issue, I want to thank you, Councilwoman Torres, because I completely agree. I think there is some nuance when it comes to the local control conversation. I think, yes, most definitely we should have the conversation. And I guess, you know, what is the line, right? And I think that would be the question I would pose to all of us, because that is the job of the state legislature, is to create state laws that impact the entire state. And if it's a matter of statewide concern, then that is what they are acting on, right? And so it's a matter of, like, how do we then determine what those priorities are and where we want to be more forceful when it comes to local control? Because I completely agree, and I think we saw that play out over the last 2 years with a couple of policies where maybe some of us wanted, like, a statewide, you know, thing to be done, and then there were other things that we all were in agreement that we didn't want that, or we wanted to have our process done because what we were doing made more sense for our you know, local jurisdiction. And so I think that it is a nuanced conversation, and it might not be a blanket, like, we just always need local control, because I don't know that all the body will be in agreement every single time on every single issue. So I think it's important, like, for us to engage in that conversation. And to Council Pro Tem, your point about the getting the agency feedback, at least since I've been here, we've been doing that all along. I think it's helpful to hear from you that providing that to council members was helpful. Mm-hmm. And so that's great feedback for us to be able to continue to do that. So I'm glad that you found that to be helpful. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thanks. And I will say you guys did a great job of that. Just for new council member, you guys aren't new anymore, but, you know, first term council members review. I want to give you a little bit of a picture of what this looked like before you all got here, right? It was one person from the mayor's office and one person from council on a meeting with our lobbyists once a week. And then we got a text message, thumbs up or thumbs down on the following three items. And that was the extent of council's state lobbying. So over the last couple of years, I want to acknowledge Councilwoman Gonzalez-Gutierrez and Councilmember Hines and the work that they have done to change that process to ensure that we have these kinds of conversations. I will also say that it makes it messy, right? Like, we're just learning how to do this. We're just figuring out how this works, especially because we need to speak as a body, separate from speaking as individual council members in our individual capacities. So, you know, really appreciate your feedback and your thoughts. And this might seem like an exercise that's, like, not valuable, but truly, it's incredibly valuable as we work with the mayor's office and our lobbyists on what this looks like and building out moving forward. So that feedback is super helpful to know that it's valuable for you all to see what's going on. I will say one of the things we added this year, you saw during special session, was in the drop-down box, need more information. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
That's great because then we can give you more information. Right? I mean, we might not be able to, but our lobbyists can give you more information. And that's really valuable and helpful for us because things happen really quickly at the state. And so the faster we can get that information to you, the faster you can make a decision so that we can take a position. So just one last slide. We talked about background check exemption for gun buyback programs, the legislative fix for accessory dwelling units mandate. I touched on this briefly. What happened was 2 years ago when ADUs came through, we could not agree on the position that we were going to take based on the very specific setback requirements that we have in our land use pieces. The mayor's office, outside of council, took a position of support and undermined council's concerns about that and cut a deal that the legislature would go back the next year and fix it. Indeed. Surprise, surprise, they didn't. So that was a learning experience for everyone in our first year, I think. But it is important that that gets fixed and that we push hard for that because that was an extremely inappropriate overstep of authority from the mayor's office. And it was a learning experience for them, too. They were brand new at the time. But it was also not okay. And so we need to go back and fix this now because we set expectations for our residents in our land use plans and community conversations that we had a very in-depth process about, public process about, as it came to ADU setbacks, and then the state totally overrode those. So that one's on this list because it's an obvious one. I think it is something that we need to push hard for, and it is something that our lobbyists are aware of. It is also something that the mayor's office, when coming back together the second year to realize that we weren't going to get the promises made that we had received, they realized kind of what's going on, and that's not going to happen anymore. So that those are two. Wanted to also have you all just start thinking about what other ones are there, right? What other priorities are there that kind of you want us to take a look at and ask the lobbyists in the mayor's office and the city agencies to take a look at to see if there are some powerful changes that we can make at the state level based on some of the challenges that we see in Denver. And I think there's just one last slide that talks about next steps. So you all, I think I mentioned, are going to get a survey. It's a really straightforward survey. It should not take very long. Please get it back to us by Monday the 13th. It will basically just ask you to rank how important is this budget priority to you, and then an open box underneath that legislative priority, anything you want us to flag for us in specific with regards to that. So just a starting place for us to create that document for this year that you got for last year of conversations between our lobbyists and the mayor's office and agencies of where we're all gonna come together. So that's the next steps. I got Flynn in the queue. Romero Campbell, you in after? All right, Councilmember Flynn.
Thank you. This is a sort of a new priority, and I don't know if I call it a priority, just so much as sort of an umbrella that covers all of our priorities, and that is, I would like the lobby team, the administration, and our analysts to look at HR 1 in 2026 and how many more problems are going to come down the road for us budget-wise, because in your presentation, you talked about the ongoing impacts of HR 1 on the state budget, and I'd like to get a better picture in relation to our 8 budget priorities what are the traps that lie ahead. I don't know how easy that will be. I don't know how difficult that will be, but that's going to really be helpful to us going forward. So that's not a new budget priority, but it's a new variable that I think we need to look at with all of our 8 priorities.
Yeah, I think that's a great flag. Mm-hmm. Council Pro Tem Romero Campbell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for process purposes, when we give the feedback, it'll be 7. Will it be a vote of 7? If there are 7 members that consider it a priority, then it's a priority for the council.
Yeah.
To pursue, or like, so what's our threshold that we're
going to Council President Sandoval has made the recommendation based on the lack of response from council members, that it be a majority of respondents. So if we can get to a majority of people responding, mm-hmm. then that will be the feedback. But there are a number of council members who just fail to respond. And that leaves us in a position where we have to, the mayor's office and council have to agree in order to have our lobbyists legislate something. And if we don't have council members responding mm-hmm. and we can't get to 7, then that hamstrings the city. So what I would like to ask for is that council members respond, please. It's really, really important. But if council members are gonna choose not to respond, that is fair. We have a lot going on, but then it will be a majority of respondents if we can get to a majority of respondents.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, that's if only like 5 people respond, 3 could take a position for this body. I think that violates the charter.
You'll have to talk to Council President Sandoval about that.
Can I add to that? Mm-hmm. Thank you. So that was actually what was presented the first year that Councilman Hines and I were doing this, and that was again in coordination with our council leadership, and that is what was presented to the body as the protocol. Then, and I think, you know, I think last year we got a lot more response, and so we were making it to 7, but there are some issues that we don't get the response that we need, and so we weren't able to take a position, and what that did was is it didn't allow us to coordinate with the mayor's office. It didn't allow us to do all these things that we really need to do, and so I think, if anything, hopefully it's an incentive for people to respond. I don't know that it violates charter because we're not talking about policy in our body that we are seeking to pass for city ordinance. Like, I think, and so we can talk about that a little bit more. But I think Council, Madam Chair, and I are planning to, when we get closer to the session, to review the process. So we have a whole different presentation on that. And so we'll review what the process is. And maybe at that time, we can maybe have more conversation about that.
I'm just concerned about how small a majority of those
absolutely.
Voting and present.
Absolutely.
Yep. Present and voting can be.
I will say the ones that we did take positions on and that the body, 7. They were more than 7.
Yes.
There were some that were almost the majority of council did say yes and take a position on something.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's a function of the way our shared contract works with the airport and the mayor's office. That in order to take a position, we have to agree, and we have found ourselves in a situation where due to lack of response from council members, we are holding up the entire process and we can't have that. So that was a great question. That's the answer. Please feel free to bring it up with Council President Sandoval. please feel free to bring it up with Council President Sandoval if you would like to. And hopefully what it does is get council members to respond. But that takes this whole conversation off the table. Other thoughts or questions?
No.
Okay. Council Member Romero Campbell, anything else?
Thank you.
Great. Wonderful. Well, then we have a bunch of items on consent. They're all appointments, I think. And so nobody called those off. And so we will, those will pass through to the full body. And seeing no one else, everyone check your inboxes, not this week, not next week, but probably the last week of September and first week of October for that survey. And we're adjourned. Thanks. Bye.